This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Raise Your Game. I'm Tasha Fussell. There are decisions that we all have to make, especially when we're all pretty much subject to the constraints of space and time. Questions like what to have for lunch, which home should we buy, who should we offer the job to? So with no set formulas in place, how do we become more effective at making decisions to solve these common questions? Author Brian Christian and cognitive scientist Tom Griffiths explores how modeling the algorithms in computer science can help us humans make better decisions. And so they explore this in their book, Algorithms to Live By, the Computer Science of Human Decisions. So I catch up with Brian to learn what an algorithm outside the world of math looks like and why it's important.
Algorithm is a word that sounds intimidating to certain people who think of it, you know, exclusively in the context of, you know, these huge tech companies like Google and Facebook and so forth. But in fact, the word algorithm just means a simple series of steps that you follow to get to a solution or make a decision. And so algorithms are, you know, taught to us in school. We learned algorithms for doing subtraction and long division. But really, you can think of following a recipe in the kitchen as being an algorithm. And so, you know, we make the argument in the book that algorithms have, in fact, been a part of human technology, not only since before the computer was invented, but in fact, since, you know, basically the Stone Age, passing down of the processes, both for making tools, but also for making decisions, has been a part of human culture from the very beginning. And so I think what the field of computer science in particular allows us to do is to think about the algorithms that we use either deliberately or instinctively for making decisions in our own lives and bring the rigor of a field like computer science to bear in terms of thinking about how we make decisions in everyday life. And so, you know, the basic idea here is that there's a class of problems that we all face in everyday life, whether that's trying to find an apartment or cleaning out our overflowing closet at home or deciding whether to go to our favorite restaurant or a new restaurant that just opened up. And we think of these as uniquely human problems, but in fact, they're not. They correspond to a fundamental class of problems within the field of computer science. And so this gives us an opportunity to think in a new way about how to approach those everyday life situations.
Okay. So in other words, these are all sort of our real life problems, except that, you know, we weren't given the formulas to figure them out in school. So everyone walks around with their own sort of algorithm, but it might not be the most effective one.
Right. That's exactly it. And so, you know, using the lens of computer science for thinking about these everyday decisions gives us both a vocabulary with which to, you know, articulate the way that we think about these things and an ability to identify when we're in one of those situations. And it also gives us a sense of what some of the ideal optimal solutions look like. And in the book, we explore this subsequent question, which is, okay, so do people actually follow what the optimal algorithm would suggest? And and those are interesting questions to consider on their own. So, I mean, you and I can, if you want, get into some of the specific domains and talk about some of the specific problems if you want.
Sure. Before we do that, I think some people might find the idea of adopting a computer algorithm a little bit, it might be an idea that might be a bit difficult for some people to accept.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, right. There's this idea that, right, we don't want to go through life like robots, right? We don't want to live in this kind of cold, mechanical way, right? Doing everything like totally by the book.
Well, actually, like, I think there is some merit to living life that way. I just think that it's difficult just purely because we're highly emotional beings.
Yes. No, I'm glad you mentioned that because, in fact, one of the things that emerges over the course of the book is that there is a powerful argument to be made on the side of emotion and intuition. And you wouldn't necessarily expect that argument to be made from the perspective of computer science, right?
Right.
We think of computers as being the paragons of this kind of hyper-rational, quote-unquote, approach where they consider every option, They iterate through all the possibilities. They think everything all the way to the end. They are deterministic. They always give the same answer to the same problem. They are exact. They give you an answer that's, you know, completely precise and completely certain is a correct answer to the problem. In fact, what I think is one of the most profound things that comes out of theoretical computer science is that there is a huge class of problems that in the field are called intractable or NP-hard problems. And when you are faced with one of these intractable problems, it is simply so difficult and there are so many possibilities to consider that you don't have the luxury of being able to take that exhaustive, exact approach.
Right.
And so, you know, and this is one of these things where, you know, up against a hard enough decision, we humans often feel like, ah, if only I had, you know, a supercomputer that could crunch through all the options. The startling thing is that against the hardest classes of problems, even a supercomputer will not do the job because it is just too hard of a problem. And so what computer scientists themselves turn to in situations like this are a host of strategies, everything from, you know, relaxing some of the constraints of the problem and imagining an easier version and seeing where they can get on the easier version. They use randomness. They use algorithms that don't always produce the same output every time. They use approximations. They trade off the cost of making an error against the cost of delay and just thinking longer, computing longer. And so often what you see then is that in cases where the problems have all of the complexity of real-world human problems, what computers do starts to look, in fact, an awful lot like what humans do in terms of these trade-offs, these approximations, this willingness to accept what's good enough and move on. And so, you know, when we humans do these things, we think of ourselves as taking these shortcuts because we, you know, can't be rational. But in fact, that's what rationality looks like when you're up against a hard problem.
Okay, so you do mention in the book that we chalk all our bad decisions up to us just being very irrational and error prone. But like you said, that's just one way of looking at it. It could be that taking these shortcuts or using these approximations are what needs to be done. Like you can't sit down. It's just not feasible to exhaust all your options and look at everything from A to Z to make a decision.
Exactly right. In many situations, in fact, the very act of considering additional options may cost you opportunities. So, you know, we raise the example in the book of, you know, looking for an apartment or a house where in many cities, the market is such that properties are only on the market so briefly before someone, you know, grabs them up. That if you're exploring your options, you basically have this situation where you need to make an irrevocable commitment either way. You see something and you either decide, okay, I'm going to take that on the spot and never know what else might have been out there, or I'm going to walk away and keep gathering data, but lose the opportunity to change my mind and come back. And so there are a lot of situations in life that have this quality. People have argued that dating has this structure where, you know, you're in a relationship and you either need to commit to that person and, you know, never know what it would have been like to have other relationships, or break up with them, in which case it's going to be hard later if you change your mind and you want them back. And so this corresponds to a class of problems that are known to mathematicians as optimal stopping problems. And here, exactly as you were saying earlier, you know, the critical question is not which of a set of options to choose, but rather how many options to even be considering in the first place.
Okay, yes. So this connects to the 37% rule. And I have to say, as I was reading it, I couldn't really grasp how you arrived or how the algorithm came to be the 37% rule. Is there a much simpler way to to explain how this works?
Well, the mathematical derivation is not for the faint of heart. I mean, it comes from the idea that it's actually 1 over the mathematical constant E, which is, you know, 2.718 something something, which gives 1 over 2.718 dot, dot, dot gives you, you know, 36.9 something something something. That's where this, you know, mysterious 37% number comes from. But let me just back up a little bit and just quickly explain the basic idea. So in the apartment hunt, for example, let's say you give yourself 1 month to find a new apartment. And you look at a series of places, and as we were saying, at each place you look at, you have to make an immediate commitment. Do you take the place that you're looking at right there on the spot, or do you let that opportunity go and walk away? And so there's a certain anxiety associated with trying to end up with the very best apartment, which is that you don't necessarily know at the beginning which one it is, because you don't have enough experience to know it when you see it. And so intuitively, I think most of us would say that, well, succeeding in this kind of situation requires a balance of looking and leaping. You're going to have to see enough places to get a sense of what a good thing is when you see it, but also be willing to leap and commit to something when it does meet that threshold. So the math tells us that is in fact exactly what you should do, but our intuition alone doesn't tell us what that threshold from looking to leaping ought to be.
Right.
And so the answer in this case is 37%. You should spend exactly 37% of your search. So if you've given yourself a month, that would be 11 days. Spend those first 11 days. Don't even bring your checkbook. You know, do not commit to anything. You're just exploring. You're just getting a feel for the market. You are just kind of calibrating. And then after that 37%, that first 11 days in this case, be prepared to immediately commit to the first thing you see that's better than what you saw in that first 37%. And so this is one of those cases where, you know, the optimal solution emerges as a result of balancing a tension between two ways that you can go wrong in this problem, right? So you can go wrong by committing too early to something that isn't actually the best in the broader pool, just because it seemed better than what you'd seen before. And you can also fail by waiting too long and holding out for an even better option that doesn't exist. And so the balance between those two risks is minimized when that threshold is 37%.
Brian Christian, the author of Algorithms to Live By, talking about how to make better decisions based on rules and algorithms that exist in computer science. We're talking about this 37% rule right now, and when we come back, we'll figure out when would be the best time to use this particular algorithm. Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Best for money, BFM 89.9.
Good morning, you're listening to Raise Your Game with me, Tasha Fusil. Brian Christian is the co-author of Algorithms to Live By, and we've been talking about how to behave more like a computer by using some of the algorithms used in computer science. Right now, we're talking about the 37% rule, which is meant to help us strike that balance between looking and leaping when there's a decision to be made. So, Brian, how do you go about identifying when an algorithm like this would be good for? Like, for example, if I'm thinking about, how do I find my ideal career? Would an algorithm like this help?
I think there's a couple different questions there. So the first question is just, you know, how do you know if you're in an optimal stopping problem in general?
Right.
And so, you know, the thing that makes anything an optimal stopping problem is this idea that you pay some cost for getting more information or getting more opportunities. And so you can think about it, let's say you're looking for a job. Let's set the career angle aside for a second, because we can come back to that. But let's just say you're looking for some job and all you really care about is, you know, the salary or something, right? And in this case, you're in an optimal stopping problem in the sense that, you know, once you make a commitment, you're going to stop looking, presumably. And if you pass something up, it will probably be hard to go back and change your mind. So it does have that kind of quality. And furthermore, you're paying some kind of cost for the additional information and additional offers that you're kind of seeking. And namely, that cost is, let's say you don't have a job in the meantime. So if it takes you a week to find a job or a job opportunity, then the cost for getting another offer is a week of salary that you've forfeited.
Right.
And so this is actually subtly different. It's still an optimal stopping problem, but it's subtly different from the apartment hunting example, because in the apartment hunting example, what you wanted was the very best place. And in this case, what you want presumably is to make the most money. And that's slightly different because a job with a slightly higher salary, you know, 6 months from now, is actually not as good as a job with almost as good of a salary that you can start right now. And so you're still in this position of wanting to maximize the total amount of money that you make, you know, minus the loss incurred by searching. We give a chart in the book if you're interested.
Okay.
Based on the range of offers that you're expecting and the cost of seeing another offer, you can determine exactly the correct, you know, salary to hold out for. And you should just always take anything equal to or above that salary. And you should just always reject everything less than or equal to that salary. Now, it's super handy to have that formula on hand, but of course it presumes that you know the range of offers to expect, and you can approximate the cost of soliciting an additional offer. So in reality, it's hard to define those things precisely, and so that's a case where we don't necessarily expect that a reader will literally cut this chart out and paste it on their wall and so forth. But it does give a sense for the general shape of the solution. And so one of the principles in a problem like this is that you should never second guess yourself. It just so happens that any offer that you reject, even if it's followed by worse offers, should not make you change your mind. And so you should just hold out for that better option and not sweat it, even if you're in what appears to be like a dry spell.
So it's just, in a way, having these algorithms helps. I mean, there's some kind of structure to the way that you're making your decisions, at least. You know, you might not even get the outcome that you want, but at least it helps the process.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think for most of us, you know, in everyday life, it's pretty natural. If you don't get the outcome you want in a situation, you start to call into question the process by which you made the decision. And I think there's this immediate kind of doubt and replay that happens just naturally, where we think, where did I go wrong in the way that I approached this situation? And I think that one of the big messages here is that some problems in life are just hard.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for example, the fine print, if you will, on the 37% rule is that it only works 37% of the time. So in fact, here's a situation where you're following the optimal algorithm, the mathematically, you know, proven best algorithm, and yet you still don't succeed all the time. In fact, you don't even succeed most of the time. You fail 63% of the time. And so this, I think, gives us some measure of consolation, which is that even if you don't get the result that you want or it doesn't work out in your favor, that doesn't necessarily mean that you approach the problem in the wrong way. Mm. And so, you know, part of the argument that we make is that if you are confident that you're approaching the decision with the correct algorithm and the correct process for making the decision, then even when you don't get what you want, you should still be able to rest easy knowing that, you know, you followed the correct way of approaching the problem, and you don't need to reconsider, you know, your decision-making approach more generally.
Okay.
So you can at least rest easy knowing that you did all that you could do.
Right. Okay, so just to get a sense of what else there is to explore in the book, Algorithms to Live By, how many of these kinds of different rules do you explore in the book, and what sort of areas do they kind of relate to? Like, is it decision-making, problem-solving? Mm-hmm. What other things do you talk about?
Yeah, so in the book really covers 11 different domains. And so optimal stopping, which is most of what you and I have been talking about, is the opening chapter of the book. And that deals with these kind of sequential search problems. And the chapter after that is about this idea in computer science that's called the explore-exploit trade-off, mm-hmm. Which corresponds pretty nicely to the problem that most of us have of deciding where to go out to eat, right? Do you want to go to your favorite place, or do you want to try something new? And this is another case where intuitively we have a sense that a life well lived is some balance between spending perhaps most of your time doing the things that you already know and love, but always staying open to new possibilities. And there is an entire literature and a wealth of information within computer science on exactly this problem, which is called the explore-exploit trade-off. And so we look at some of the algorithms for making those kinds of decisions. And we likewise look at sorting which is a huge branch of computer science, and ask questions like, you know, what's the best way to alphabetize your bookshelf? But more importantly, should you alphabetize your bookshelf? And we find that computer science actually provides a surprising argument in favor of being messy. And we look at things like storage management. So all of us have these overflowing closets at home, and we feel like we need to kind of tidy up. And so there's a domain in computer science that's called caching that deals with how to manage memory effectively and keep the most important things closest at hand. So that gives us a way of thinking about, you know, home organization from this rigorous mathematical standpoint, which is what most, you know, self-help books on getting organized don't offer. Mm-hmm. So we can offer advice that's actually backed up by proofs. And so, like I said, as the book kind of moves into the second half, we broaden the lens a bit and we look at the techniques that computer scientists have developed for dealing with intractable problems. So things like randomness, relaxation, approximation. And we think about these strategies for kind of taming or making approachable even the hardest classes of problems. And then the end of the book looks at networking and game theory. So in many human arenas, the complexity of the decisions that we make gets immediately ratcheted up when those decisions become social, when they affect other people, or we have to kind of imagine the intentions of the other people that we're interacting with. Mm-hmm. And so there's a way of thinking computationally, even about those interpersonal relationships as well.
What would your advice be to someone for them to be able to actually apply these algorithms in real life, especially when it's kind of very alien or foreign to the way that mm-hmm. they've done things?
Yeah, I mean, so in some cases in the book, what we end up giving the reader is a concrete precise number, right? So the 37% rule tells you exactly when to go from looking to leaping. In other cases, rather than offering a specific number, what we try to do is distill the literature into what we feel are the key principles in the area. So one of the key principles in the explore-exploit trade-off is your willingness to try new things should depend on how much time you have to enjoy a great new thing that you discover. So, for example, if it's your last night in town and you're moving out of the country, it's probably not worth going to a new restaurant that just opened up because it's probably not going to be as good as your favorite restaurant.
Right.
And, you know, if you find out that you have a life-threatening illness or something like this, you're probably going to want to spend more time with your close family and less time, you know, reaching out and trying to make new friends, that kind of thing. Likewise, when you move to a new city, you should be exceptionally willing to meet new people and try new things. And so that's one of these principles that gives us, just at the very basic level, a way of thinking about these everyday decisions and realizing that, you know, all of us perceive ourselves to be somewhere along some continuum of time, whether it's how old we are in life, you know, where we are in our lifespan, or how long we are going to be living in a particular city or in, you know, attending school at a particular school. And that naturally our decisions kind of change as a function of where we are on that continuum. And then broadly, the explore-exploit trade-off becomes a way of thinking about just the arc of human life, that we think of babies and infants as kind of random and always having a short attention span and always being interested in new things and very restless and bored easily and always moving on to new things. And we think of older people as being very set in their ways, very kind of fixed in their habits, do the same things, you know, over and over. And by the logic of the explore-exploit trade-off, well, both of those things are, in fact, the optimal way to be approaching life based on being at the beginning or the end of your time. So it gives us a new way of thinking about just the whole arc of human life.
Brian Christian, the co-author of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. This has been Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.